by starting with truly phenomenal produce, you don't actually have to do that much to make a great meal. Curate the stuff that goes into the food carefully and do that. That is a privilege that I would not have been afforded had I opened a place in the city.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. After the events of the last 2 years, many of us are seeing the value in regional travel, and many in the industry are creating new lives in regional towns too. As everyone looks to get out on the road and explore Australia, will we see the regional restaurant boom we're expecting? What does it take to create a destination restaurant that keeps in mind the local market too? Rowan Tahima is the owner and chef of the Mermaid Beach House in Coffs Harbour, New South Wales. Rowan, how are you?
I'm really well, really well.
You've chosen an interesting period of time to open a restaurant during a pandemic in a regional area. What was it like in 2020 when you first opened the doors of the Mermaid?
Look, the restaurant wouldn't have opened if it wasn't for the pandemic. There was no way that it would have happened at all. So back in March of 2020, just before the very first Melbourne lockdown, I was sitting in my apartment going down into winter in an apartment that had no natural light, and I decided to get out. And wow. So I called up my little brother, and he drove down overnight on the eve of the first lockdown. We packed all of my apartment up in a day and then drove back through the night again to be back in Coffs Harbour.
Wow. And
it's funny. The birth of the place was literally a response to COVID and me just being bored in a new place.
Well, tell us about why Coffs Harbour. What's important in that region for you?
Oh, look, it's funny. My family's been up here for 20-odd years. My mum was the director of the local gallery up here. And so in her great wisdom, started buying up little properties to help get her children onto the property ladder, and has slowly, progressively moved all three of her sons into the local area to be closer to her. Unfortunately, by the time I got here, all that was left was a little granny flat at the back of one of my brother's houses. So, but anyway, I'm very grateful for the granny flat nonetheless.
Is the restaurant that you have today, is that the vision that you thought of originally in September when you were about to open?
Oh, not at all. No, look, I came into Coffs thinking that it would be a really value-driven market. And that I'd open something that was casual, great food. You know, we were always going to make all of our pasta from scratch and do as much as we could from first principles. But I thought, look, there's going to be a price ceiling that if you're pitching to a regional market, that you just have to make it cheaper. And so that's where it started, and it just isn't where it's ended up.
What made you realize the need for something a bit more extravagant than sort of an easy, accessible, casual restaurant?
The customers. You know, it's like I think that a restaurant is really you have an owner's hopes and dreams. You know, like we all go into a place, opening a place with what we think would be great and what would work. But ultimately, your customers play such a huge role in dictating what works, and you've just got to continue to listen and continue to iterate until you find something that both parties can be happy with, you know, that are ecstatic by. You know, it's especially in a smaller market where we've got 73,000 in the LGA, but you know, that's over a fairly huge distance. So what's that? Three Melbourne suburbs, not even, maybe two Melbourne suburbs. And so you've got to get people coming back. You know, if you don't have local custom and regular local custom, then you have no opportunity to grow.
The industry has had its challenges in the last 2 years, but regional Australia has had it a little bit different to the cities. How have you felt the last 2 years operating this restaurant?
Look, I feel so incredibly lucky. I had no expectation that we would be off the ground so quickly. Even with the lockdowns, you know, what we lost 5 weeks or 6 weeks, I think, to, you know, everyone got sent home. But that seems, you know, such a trifling amount of time compared to, you know, the heartache that everyone's gone through elsewhere in Australia. Mm. So, look, the thing that you are aware of, though, is that even though everyone else is in lockdown in the capital cities, you don't have tourists coming. So you've really got to focus on the people that are around you. You know, it's, they become more important than ever.
Tell us about the local community and the local producers as well. What sort of connections have you made that have helped bring this restaurant to life?
Oh, look, you know, we've continued to grow. Like the restaurant's just over a year old now, and I only feel like we're beginning to finalize who it is that we will eventually be. It's as the longer the period of time that I've managed to spend here, the deeper the connection I have with the people around me to grow and fish and the produce that we end up using. That my mum, to return to my mum for the second time, always taught me to fish my feet first. She's a keen angler. So, you know, her philosophy is that, you know, you're going out fishing, you cast a line, don't cast it over the horizon, cast it immediately around you. And it's that kind of idea that I've used to underpin our sourcing. You know, it's like, obviously, we will always get some stuff out of Sydney. Some produce comes out of Brisbane, but the vast majority of the stuff that I use is stuff that's grown by the people in the food bowl immediately around us. And so I think I had originally thought that the menu would be this thing that came out of my head and it would be crafted. You know, if you have a massive supply chain around you and all of the great produce, then you can make it anything you want. But rather it's turned into, well, what are people growing? What do I have easy access to? What's objectively delicious? And then how do I treat that produce with as much care as I can, just not to stuff it up?
You've mentioned your mum a few times, but take us back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play in your family?
Oh, it's interesting. Mum's a terrible cook. Terrible. I'm just going to hear this and I'm going to never hear the end of it. But one of the reasons I can cook is because she can't. You know? I come from my dad was a cook as well. And so I grew up in kitchens. It's the only way I got pocket money. You know, you start in the dish pit and you slowly work your way onto the line, or you start doing prep and then eventually you get a spot on the line. So cooking's always been a part of what I did. But, it's funny. When I finally got out of Darwin, I moved to Melbourne to be closer to my mother. My parents had long split by then and kind of stopped working in the kitchen and started working on the floor.
Tell us about that transition, because you have quite a fascinating career that's bounced between professional kitchen and sommelier, which is pretty rare. What's it been like having your foot in both sort of camps?
Well, you know, the amazing thing is I think I got to Melbourne back in 93, the end of 93, and the industry was very different back then. You know, it's I had gone to Melbourne to go to university, and cooking and going to uni, just they do not work. You know, cooking is a thing that requires a huge amount of dedication to doing it right. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, well, I'll work on the floor then. And so I ended up getting a commie waiter's job at Walter's Wine Bar at Southgate with Walter and Maria Burke. I think this was 1994 by now. And I think at the time they had three hats. Mm. I think back then you could get five hats. Yeah, crazy. So the thing that got me into wine was, you know, at the end of the day, and this is testament to Walter Burke, all of the wine that had come in as samples over the course of the day, and people were dropping off samples there, like, there'd be a case of wine that would arrive from a variety of different people every day. They would open up all of the wine at the staff meal would be at the end of the day, and they'd open up all of the wine, and then you'd collectively talk about it as a group.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know, it predates Wessett. And so I just, I think even Patrick Walsh was still at the restaurant at that stage. So, you know, it was just this hotbed of talent and learning. And so it was very easy to fall in love with wine there. And so it just, I was at uni for a long time, far too long, if you ask my mum. I think 8 years. So in the 8 years that I was at uni, I kind of worked my way through a progression of different restaurants. And I had found, you know, I had this kind of dual education, one formal in at university, and then one informal in wine. And yeah, that was a great place to be.
Well, it led to some incredible roles, including sommelier at Nobu. What was that like, trying to create the beverage experience in a restaurant that's sort of global?
Look, the resources that Nobu have is remarkable, and the pockets, the deep pockets. And so you just had access to basically anything that you wanted. So in an environment where money is of no issue and that you can just buy pretty much anything, then it's actually the act of curation that becomes the principal task. It's like, how do you put a range of things together? Because you can't have an infinitely long wine list, especially not in something that is as high tempo as Nobu was when we first opened. And so you've got to craft something that is punchy, offers both extravagance and value, is interesting, like a kind of builds excitement within the diner, as well as, and at the time I had very little experience with sake, as well as trying to learn an entirely new beverage category.
You had a balancing act between front of house and owning your own venues as well. What was the trigger for you to step out and go out on your own?
Look, I think that I have had the great fortune to work with so many incredible chefs and operators along the way. I mean, time with Andrew McConnell, time with Jeff Lindsay, who taught you a lot, and especially Andrew. And working for Andrew was like going to a finishing school for young restaurateurs.
You know, wow.
I think that the quality of training they provide sets people up with a pathway of, okay, well, I understand the fundamentals of how a good hospitality business should work, and then it's up to you to put your imprint. You've got to actually have something to say. You know? And so I think that once you can establish what your own personal vision is, then you've got the tool set, I guess, to run forward with it.
Well, you put yourself into a restaurant in Armidale, of all places. What led to the move to there?
Well, actually, you know what? I had just come back from working in Norway. So I'd done an 18-month stint in Norway, cooking up in the Arctic Circle. And so I came back flush with money. and full of the confidence of wanting to be able to cook my own food in my own setting. And so found myself at the gallery there. So, I'm going to count this. This is number three. My mother at the time was the doing locum work as the director of the gallery up there at the New England Regional Art Museum. And so before I left to go to Norway, she had asked me to write a one-page brief on how they could fix their hospitality space. And I trot off to the other side of the world. Had no particular plan other than having an opportunity to cook somewhere else. Do 18 months there, find myself with a bunch of cash, come back to Australia, and then use that one pager to actually as the business plan for my first restaurant.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's I loved that restaurant. It's funny. I needed to do that restaurant. I needed to get that restaurant out of my system before I could do another. So it was a beautiful restaurant, but I refused to fix the cuisine in any particular style. And so rather we would change the food based on whim. So each month I'd choose a different cuisine based on places that I'd traveled and cooked. So it was a bit vainglorious, to be honest. You know, it's like, get over yourself. I think it's funny. Like Australian cooks, by and large, we're journeymen. You know, we'd lack the deep, granular knowledge of any particular cuisine, and so we're very good at lots of things, excellent at very few. And ultimately, I think that's certainly what Harvest turned out to be. It was a great little place. I loved it. You know, it's over the run there, we managed to set up a music festival and open a community garden, and it really gave insight. Armidale provided that kind of sense of certainty that a regional community can come together to celebrate something collectively. You know, that I felt really well supported there, and it certainly gave me confidence that when I decided to open up here, that it would be an opportunity to again feel that sense of love from a population, from an audience.
You mentioned that Harvest was a restaurant that you had to get out of your system. What were the lessons that you learned from that experience?
Oh, don't make it all about you. A restaurant's not about you. Yeah, it's like it certainly has to have a part of you in it, and but it can't be just 100% about you. If it is, then you're just too full of your own brio, I guess. Yeah, it was kind of gross. I even had a portrait of myself hung in the restaurant, and I'd never do that again.
I want to circle back, because you mentioned about 18 months of your life that sounded pretty fascinating in the Arctic Circle. Do you have any stories from chefing in that time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was wild. Yeah, it's like Australia is really blessed when it comes to seafood, and the quality of seafood we get is generally excellent. And the range of it is phenomenal. You get a much smaller range of seafood in Norway, but the quality of it would be almost even better.
Wow.
So I travelled to Norway to spend time with other hospo mates who had just on the cusp of starting a family. And so I went to see my godson born. And I thought that would be a six-week stint. And then I had lined up a stage at NAM. I was going to go and cook Thai food for a year.
Wow.
But got there, and Norway's a funny place. Each winter, or each summer, they basically send their entire workforce on summer holiday. So everyone goes at the same time.
Wow.
Yeah. And so what they do over that period of time is they import labor from everywhere, because they've just got Norway, you know, has Norway money. They've got that massive sovereign fund of theirs. And so they have these incredible levels of social services. Mm. And so they import people from everywhere. And so I walked into an environment just thinking I'd pick up a job on the line for, you know, 6 weeks, earn some money, spend some time with Matt, drink Russian vodka. To find that there was I'd walked into an absolute bin fire of a restaurant that desperately needed just a little bit of guidance. That 6 week stint turned into, you know, 3 months, and 3 months turned into 6 months. And then suddenly I was the exec chef over a couple of hotels.
Wow.
Up in Kirkenes, or Kirkenes. So to put that into context, Kirkenes is about as far north and as far east as you can go in Norway without crossing into Russia.
Wow.
So it's the terminus point for Hurtigruten. Hurtigruten is the coastal steamer that goes up through all of the fjords. So it starts in Bergen in the south and then ends in Kirkenes in the north. And so if you're going on Hurtigruten the full length, you'll either fly into or fly out of Sheikahnes. So it's a funny town. It's only 3,000 people. It's about as far away from Oslo as you can be while still being in Norway. And it gets a fair number of tourists. So that's where I found myself cooking. Immediately reached out and pulled together a crew of other Australian cooks.
Wow.
And we just had this little corner in the Arctic for a good run. Have you ever had king crab?
Yes.
Yeah. It's like king crab's endemic across all the Kamchatka, that's all the way across the top of Russia, through Canada and certainly around Norway. So you'd go into the fjord, if you put goggles on, you can just see king crabs basically everywhere. during summer, you'd go down and people would swim out and lay down a net. They'd just leave for a couple of hours. You'd go back with a spear later and then just spear all of the king crabs and then grab the four corners of the net and maybe pull up 80, 90 kilos of crab. And we'd just set up 44-gallon drums with fjord water. And then just put fires under them, get them boiling, dump in the crab, and that's how we'd do a staff party.
Wow.
Yeah. And Aussies being Aussies, very early in our tenure, we bought a jerry can, a brand new jerry can, and then kicked it around a car park until it looked all banged up. We used to drive across into Russia and fill that jerry can up with vodka. Because you buy a bottle of vodka in Nikel, which is the closest town to Sheikahnes, across the border, for about $2 Australian, and a bottle of gin at the state-run alcohol store. So all alcohol in Norway is sold through state-run or state-owned stores. So they control everything, and there's very high taxation on booze in Norway. So Australians being, the degenerate alcoholics we are, would drive across to Russia, fill up a jerry can with kind of 50 litres of vodka, and then drive it back across the border. No one ever checked. You'd even drive to Finland to buy beer because beer is in Finland is about the same cost as the beer in Australia, about $40 a slab or $50 a slab, $40 a slab 10 years ago.
Tell us about what you were cooking there. Were there some ingredients that you hadn't used before? And how do you create a menu for an environment like that you're not familiar with?
Experimentation. I was surrounded by people smarter than me. I always try to be the least talented cook in my kitchen. The opportunity to experiment with new things. I mean, that's the fun bit. So the Sami are the proper name for Eskimos in the area, they're nomadic herdsmen of reindeer. And so, cooking reindeer, it's like venison. That was great fun. The king crab, the best halibut I've ever eaten. The texture and quality of it was extraordinarily good. And it makes, though very, very expensive to do here in Australia, the best fish and chips I've ever eaten. The Norwegians, especially being based in a hotel, hotels in Norway are expected to provide a buffet of food quite frequently. Quite frequently, they'll do it for a day a week or especially over Christmas. There's lots of Christmas buffets. That's how they tend to entertain. Probably not so much now with COVID, but certainly at the time. And one of the mainstays on a Norwegian Christmas buffet is lutefisk. Lutefisk is fish that's been cured in lye, or traditionally it had been even done with urine. Wow. And it has this very, very pungent, I'm not going to say offensive because someone will probably write a letter, but I would go as far to say unpleasant smell, stench, stench, is reasonable on the palate. It has a kind of caramelly flavour. It's an acquired taste. But it was an expected mainstay on the menu. I even had to cook minke whale in Norway, actually.
Wow.
It's a Norway and Japan per capita, the highest consumers of whale in the world. And if you haven't tried whale, it does not have a whole lot for me to advocate in its case for. It has this kind of deep livery, almost bloody flavour that's quite pervasive. And despite significant experimentation, I'm yet to find a way to make whale taste objectively delicious.
Well, back in Australia, you've had regional restaurants sort of a decade apart. Are regional restaurants different to a decade ago?
Yeah, I think that I'm better at it now than I was a decade ago. That's certainly things. But I think that the basic fundamentals are somewhat similar in that there is always going to be a skills gap, that you're always going to spend time having to build staff from the ground up, which is a good thing. You know, it's if so long as you go in expecting it, that you're not just going to be able to advertise for a sous chef and expect for great candidates to come knocking. Though if there are any great candidates, call me. So that's one. Certainly, the expectation that the staffing is you have to build that for yourself and build a team and really aim to give people the jobs that they want, so you get longer tenure. It's like the longer you can hold on to someone in a regional area, the better. Two is that you can't ever take your eye off a local market, that you don't have an infinite number of customers to burn. But sometimes I feel like cooking in the city, restaurants build a regular clientele, and they do represent a small but very valuable component to the overall revenue a restaurant creates. But in a regional area, return diner makes up a significant proportion of your overall revenue. And so whatever you do, it has to people have to respond to it, and they have to want to dine with you again and again and again. So you very much, in this restaurant especially, the restaurant was almost designed by the people that kept on coming. They wanted more seafood. We got more seafood. They wanted to spend more money and stay longer in the venue. Great, I'll make it more comfortable for you. When we opened, we had two wines, a red wine and a white wine that I had shipped up from Melbourne, and we're doing in kegs because it's all I could afford. I had no money, no money at all. And so we started very modestly, a red wine, white wine, and a Prosecco, just a cheap Prosecco. I think at the time I bought out of Dan's because, I had nothing to spend. And gradually over time, it's like now, I think we've got four Barbariscos, a handful of Barolo.
Wow.
Yeah, and they sell. It's an interesting dynamic that if you allow your customers to kind of give you those insights, it's the best way that you can perfect. And just not being so too much of an egotist. It's not about you, it's about them.
The summer could be one of the busiest ever for regional areas in Australia. How are you feeling about that?
Yeah, I'm just growing as quickly as I can. My little brother and one of my apprentices spent a couple of days working mostly in the rain, paving out our front garden. That will add an extra 20 seats.
Wow.
And it's also, I see it as a massive opportunity again. So I'm intending on have just sent a shipping container to a builder, which we're going to build out and put a pizzeria in the backyard.
Wow.
It's astounding. Like the restaurant itself sits on a 1,000 square meter block immediately opposite the ocean. You can't see it through the scrub, but you walk across the road and you walk down a path and you are at the beach. And the place had lain empty for 2 years. It boggled my mind that I might be lucky enough to be the custodian of the space. And being COVID, I was able to negotiate hard because, then, as I've previously mentioned, I had no money. I could not afford a director's guarantee on the rent. So I was able to negotiate a long rent-free period and just start with the absolute basics. Mm. There's nothing like poverty to encourage innovation.
You've had an extraordinary career and now operating a great regional restaurant that's full of promise at the moment. What do you love about what you're doing?
Lots of things. I'm finally in a position where I'm talking to farmers about what I'm hoping they will grow for me in the coming seasons. It's an interesting experience to start designing a menu by starting at the beginning of a supply chain.
Wow.
It's like I have a woman who grows all of my tomatoes. She's amazing. Chinky, if she ever hears this. I actually think that she might be a magician. There is no other godly reason that one person should be able to get tomatoes so ripe in what has been a pretty average season so far, but just extraordinarily good. I've got people growing me broad beans, but I only want them the size of my finger. By starting with truly phenomenal produce, then you don't actually have to do that much to make a great meal. It's just fine. Just curate the stuff that goes into the food carefully and do that. So that, number one, I think that is a privilege that I would not have been afforded had I opened a place in the city.
Mm.
Two is the act of building a team, building a real family of, misfits. We're all misfits. giving people jobs that they adore. It's like gone are the days where you can just be an ass and yell at people. It's an ineffective way of managing a team anymore. Watching people grow, it's a massive privilege.
Well, you're only a year in, but you're making an incredible impact, and this period of time has given you opportunity to really explore your passion. But what are you looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Look, if I play my cards right, if I'm very, very, very lucky, I might actually get to start a family. I've always considered myself too selfish to have a family. That's why I've opened restaurants. I think that much like my staff, I'd like to build the kind of venue that that allows for a real sense of work-life balance and allows people to do things that if they wanted to, kids would be something that sit within that realm of possibility. So, fingers crossed on that.
Well, Rowan, I hope that happens, and amazing to hear what you're doing in Coffs Harbour. We've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today to hear your story. Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Pleasure to chat.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.